Tax Update for Saturday, February 17th, 2007. Welcome to Tax Update for Saturday, February the 17th, 2007. This week, there's English and there's the IRC, passive, active conduct, and carrying on. The Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and supporting documents may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the podcast. Such a prohibited use would include using the podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services, located on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information to tax practitioners that subscribe to their services. Again, you can visit them on the web at www.lineburgservices.com. Well, this week we're going to look at what happens when Congress defines what are apparently similar words in different fashions. We're going to look at the area of what is a passive activity or items where practitioners have tended to lump together the treatments under various provisions on the code because they seem related to the concept of being passive or actively involved in a trade or business. And we're going to go through specifically some of the issues as to when that doesn't work, in fact, quite often doesn't work, and how these specific provisions are very different from one another, and why it's important to understand their differences, and why you may get what appear to be inconsistent results under different code sections for the same activity. Now, I was going to mention one thing before we go on. If you've been receiving this podcast via the Lineberg Services website, you may have noticed that the podcast went missing for a period there, and then last week suddenly two showed up together. We had a few technical difficulties in getting things uploaded to their site. Those getting it through the Libsyn feed never noticed that anything changed because that one kept going. We have now, we believe, solved the technical difficulties on the Lineberg Services site, so the Lineberg Services site should be producing the podcast and having it come out basically at the same time as it comes out of the Libsyn site. So both of them should be coming together, so if you're getting this from that site, hopefully the information will go up there at the same time that it goes up to the other locations, and we should have all of our podcasts put together. But if you had an issue or you wondered why things got grouped, that was the issue we were dealing with back during the past couple of weeks. Now, this week, as we talked about, the Internal Revenue Code contains a number of provisions either use the term passive or use a concept that tax professionals tend to reference back to the idea of the passive standard. Now, the term passive became a big deal over 20 years ago now, with the Tax Reform Act of 1986, when suddenly every tax practitioner was talking about passive or worrying about what was passive. And today, we still have that concept of passive that we deal with, but we also deal with the concept of being passively or actively involved or materially involved, depending upon our issue or our viewpoint here, in a certain activity and trying to apply that to other provisions of the code. Because there are other places where Congress decided that the level of activity may or may not have an impact on how things are handled. And for that reason, we need to look at these similar areas. This week, we're going to take a look at a few areas for the many faces of passive activities, looking at the question of passive, active, or actively involved under Section 469, which is kind of our lead passive section. We're going to look at the issue of being actively involved in a trade or business under Section 179, which is actually a requirement to be able to get 179 deductions. We're going to talk about the concept of the S corporations and passive incomes, and the S corporations issue in Section 1362 with the excess passive income tax and its relationship to 469, which turns out really is virtually none, as well as the potential impact on Section 1402 and self-employment taxes of the various concept of passive versus active for the applicability of the self-employment tax, especially in the context of a partner. Now, as noted, the big section that we all tended to get involved in or that people tend to think of when you say the word passive is what is actually Section 469 of the Internal Revenue Code. That's where the passive loss rules are found. The provision was added in the 1986 Tax Act, and for those of us old enough to have been around when that came in, we remember that was added to the code primarily to stop the sale of what were then a lot of tax shelters. In the world that we lived in prior to the 86 Act, there was a lot of promotion of limited partnership investments to individuals that wanted to shelter income. And those individuals would buy the limited partnership. They wouldn't really do anything. They'd put money down. And in those days, we had things like multipliers where you put $10,000 in, you get $10,000 back in credits and apparent tax benefits. So see, it really didn't cost you anything to get into this partnership. And voila, the tax savings paid for the investment. So you buy this limited partnership. Well, Congress got upset because these things were getting wilder and wilder. And Congress came down as part of the 1986 tax simplification with the concept of the passive activity rules, which may be many things, but simplification, they really weren't. And 469 has become one of the more complicated and convoluted sections of the code, except maybe it's dirt simple because you came to the conclusion that if in doubt, if it's a loss, it's probably passive, and if in doubt, if it's income, it's probably not. And actually, the section virtually gave the IRS the authority to make a findings that were pretty close to that level of finding. Now, the actual definition of what is a passive activity for Section 469 is found in 469C. And that section tells us to be a passive activity, the term passive activity under the general rule requires you to have two tests. First, to be a passive activity, the activity must involve the conduct of a trade or business. And, secondly, it has to be one in which the taxpayer does not materially participate. Well, there's our first concept. Now we've got material participation as our issue. And under Section 469H, we get a definition of material participation. This is a definition that gets expanded dramatically in the regulations. But it tells us under 468H1, a taxpayer shall be treated as materially participating in the activity only if the taxpayer is involved in the operation of the activity on a basis which is regular, continuous, and substantial. So now we have regulations under Section 469 that go into many details about telling us exactly what is that necessary, regular, substantial, and continuous activity. But we have a few special rules we find under H. Number 2, an interest in a limited partnership. That provides that in general, except as provided in regulations, no interest in a limited partnership as a limited partner shall be treated as an interest with respect to which the taxpayer materially participates. So by definition, a limited partnership becomes a passive activity if it's carrying on a trade or business just because, by definition, we are told, the taxpayer cannot materially participate. And if a taxpayer does not materially participate, that makes it into a passive activity, except as provided by the regulations. Now, there are certain special rules here that go on in the rest of this section for treatments of retired individuals, surviving spouses, the applicability to closely held C corporations and personal service corporations of these rules, and the participation by the spouse. As we said, now, there are a number of other special rules added in. First, Congress said that rental activities are defined as passive activities under 469C2. That's a definition that rental is there, with a special rule for active rental real estate that gives the special allowance we're used to, which you find in Section 469I. And then, on top of that, Congress later came along and added the special provision for real estate professionals under Section 467C7. Now, these are all statutory definitions of what is or is not passive, basically by definition. And some of these don't matter what you do. For instance, we took a look at the limited partnership. Regardless of the level of activity a person is involved with under the general rule, it is going to be a passive activity. Similarly, regardless of the level of activity in general, a rental will be a passive activity unless you can get under the special rule for rental for real estate professionals. Finally, working interests in oil and gas wells under Section 469C3 get a special break because they are defined as being basically active, or they meet the material participation even if you don't do basically anything, if you have a working interest in oil and gas that you hold directly. That was a special rule that went into the law. So these are all statutory definitions of passive versus active. Now, what's important to these issues is that we have we had these special rules that bring them in statutorily. Now, we should add a couple of other statutory additions that we need to look at. Congress added some provisions that bring certain activities that would not be a trade or business under the rules of 469 because they were concerned about people dodging under this. The special rules yank in research and experimental activity under Section 174, that's found at 469C5, and allow the IRS to bring in certain activities that are related to a trade or business or simply for the production of income that are allowed under Section 2, where deductions are allowed under Section 212, and that's found at C6. Conceptually, Congress was looking at passive as a reference that were being marketed. The whole point was, remember, 469's point was to shut down these marketed limited partnership interests and similar tax shelters that were being sold to people. Because Congress understood that the marketers of these were very resourceful, shall we say, and would certainly try to work their way around any rules Congress wrote, Congress looked to change this a little bit and decided to go back in and give the IRS rather broad authority to specify regulations. This regulatory authority is found in Section 469L. That provides specific authority for the IRS to prescribe regulations as may be necessary or appropriate to carry out the provisions of this section, including regulations, one, that specify what constitutes an activity, material participation, or active participation for purposes of this section, that secondly provide that certain items of gross income will not be taken into account determining income or loss from an activity and the treatment of expense allocable to such income. Think about the real estate being rented to your 100% owned corporation, and you begin to understand the use of that particular provision that was allowed for the IRS to reclassify items. Requiring net income or gain from limited partnership or other passive activity to be treated as not from a passive activity. Provide for the determination of the allocation of interest expense for purposes of this section, and which deal with changes in marital status and changes between joint and separate return. Now, the IRS has made quite detailed use of this authority in regulations, defining what is a passive activity, the level of activity necessary to achieve material participation status, and the various other issues. You'll find the regulations at 1.469-1 through 11. Some are final, some continue in temporary form. Now, a little caveat. As you may know today, a temporary regulation has to become final within 10 years. However, these regs have been out much longer than 10 years. How can they be temporary and still be valid if they've been out more than 10 years? There's the glitch. Congress put the provision in requiring that regs go from temporary to final status within 10 years, or basically temporary regulations would expire within 10 years if they didn't go final. But that was only for regulations issued after the effective date, and this particular provision was added to the law just after these regulations went out in temporary form. Therefore, they can stay around forever. Remember that the goal of Section 469 was to shut down these issues. If those of you who are in practice in 1986 may remember that initially after the 86 Act, there was a lot of press given to the creation of what was called PIGs, or passive income generators. And there were all kinds of the tax shelter groups and the marketers, because, I mean, these people were looking at staying in business, so their theory was, we'll just create PIGs. PIGs will be passive income generators that will take income that wouldn't have been passive, but will run it through this particular device. It'll become passive, and then the taxpayers will be able to still take their losses against it because we converted to passive activity income under a standard, basically, conversion of income type tax planning, the sort of thing that we've seen done for years in capital gains and like where we want to take income if we can and convert it to a different type that has a better tax advantage. Well, IRS rather quickly issued the regulations and guidance that made it clear that anytime you came up with an idea for a PIG, the IRS was going to come up with a regulation that said the PIG didn't work. Therefore, we never really saw PIGs, and what really happened was Section 469 served to shut down that industry. Now, the problem we run into is, though, a lot of practitioners who have grown up after that, who came through that system, now take that, because there's a lot of time spent on that definition. We think about that definition a lot, and we work with it a lot. Taxpayers and their, I should say, taxpayers' advisors, unfortunately, often try to take this definition and then make this square peg fit in the round hole of other provisions under the code. Let's take a look at three areas where taxpayers have been known to, or where taxpayers' advisors have been known to try to apply this provision, and we'll talk about the fact of why it doesn't work or what the different rules are. First, let's start Section 179, the expensing deduction. Interesting place to go. If you go to Section 179B3 Cap A, you're going to find a reference to when we get to the limitation on taking Section 179 expensing deductions based on income from a trade or business. We're told the amount allowed as a deduction for any taxable year shall not exceed the aggregate amount of taxable income of the taxpayer for such taxable year which is derived from the active conduct by the taxpayer of any trade or business. Now, the term active conduct is interesting because it doesn't just say from a trade or business, but there's a requirement here that we have active conduct. Now, active kind of sounds like the antonym of passive, right? We have passive and active. Well, you know, we kind of remember that unfortunately under the 469 rules, you had passive and material participation, but let's not worry about that. Active passive, so that's like the antonym-synonym situation. So a lot of practitioners think that's the same basic rule, meaning if it's not a passive activity, then I'm automatically active conduct. Secondly, if it is a passive activity, I'm automatically not active conduct. Well, unfortunately, that's not the way 169 reads. In fact, Regulation 1.179-2C6II defines what is meant by active conduct, and that's probably the definition that we have. And it notes that for purposes of this section, the determination of whether trade or business is actively conducted by a taxpayer is to be made from all the facts and circumstances and is to be applied in light of the purpose of the active conduct requirements of this section. And in the context of this section, the purpose of the active conduct requirements is to prevent a passive investor in a trade or business from deducting Section 179 expenses against taxable income derived from that trade or business. Now, that's probably an unfortunate use of terms. The bad news is, if you take a look at this, you're going to find these regs kind of predate our issue for 469, but nevertheless, kind of, it's one of those little issues that we run into where the use of the term passive, but it does not make a reference to passive under Section 469. What it does say is, consistent with this purpose, a taxpayer generally is considered to actively conduct a trade or business if the taxpayer meaningfully participates in the management or operations of the trade or business. So you have a meaningful participation test. Generally, a partner is considered to actively conduct a trade or business of the partnership if the partner meaningfully participates in management or operates a trade or business. A mere passive investor in a trade or business does not actively conduct the trade or business. So to take a deduction for Section 179, we have to show the taxpayer was actively involved in the conduct of that trade or business. Unfortunately, it's still a rather fuzzy test because there's no issue there as to, it's not the same as the passive activity regulations where we get various hours testings and other rules that determine if we're passive or active. Rather, this is a vaguer definition. Now, an example at Reg 1.179-2C6II, the IRS gives an example to explain the requirement. Let's take a look at the example. In the example, A owns a salon as a sole proprietorship, and A employs B to operate it. A periodically meets with B to review the developments relating to the business. A approves the annual budget prepared by B. B does all the operating functions, such as hiring beauticians, acquiring the supplies, and writing checks to pay the bills. In 1991, B purchases provided for in the salon's annual budget equipment costing $9,500 for use in the conduct of the business. There were no other purchases of 179 property during that year. And the net income for the year totaled $8,000. A is also a partner in PRS, a calendar year partnership which owns a grocery store. C, who is a partner in PRS, runs a grocery store for the partnership, making all the management operating decisions. That entity didn't purchase any Section 179 property during 1991. A's allocable share of partnership net income was $6,000. So before 179, we have $14,000 of business income. Based on the facts and circumstances, A meaningfully participates in management of the salon. That was the amount for $8,000 of income. However, A does not meaningfully participate in the management or operation of the trade or business of the partnership. So A's deduction for Section 179 is limited to the $8,000. Now, continue that on. Because of the way the 179 rules worked, if A had actively was actively involved in the conduct of the partnership business, then that $6,000 of income would have been added to the $8,000. And A would have been allowed to take the full $9,500 deduction because this particular provision, while it limits you to your income from a trade or business, does not limit you to the income from the trade or business in which the Section 179 expense is incurred. Now, obviously, we have S corporations and partnerships, and we have the entity test there that may effectively serve as that in that case. But in this case, as a sole proprietorship, that proprietorship could show a net loss. If we had other trade or business income, we would still get the Section 179 deduction. The example that comes to mind all the time in that area is that performance of services as an employee is a trade or business. Therefore, and in a joint return, we combine both spouses. So even if A had the beauty salon losing money, A could still be able to get a 179 deduction for that equipment if, in fact, A's spouse had income from their wages that was enough to basically give us enough positive trade or business income to allow the deduction. But getting back to our passive versus active rules, note that the regulations make no reference to the regulation of Section 469 itself. That's not an oversight. The actual term active conduct of a trade or business is not used in Section 169. Now, obviously, some of the factors that would affect your determination of whether somebody is materially participating for purposes of Section 469 would also probably be relevant in considering if it meets the active conduct test of Section 179. But there is no reason to believe that the two tests trigger at the same instant, or that the Section 469 regulations serve either to show you exactly when you meet the test for Section 179 or when you fail to meet the test for Section 179. So that means that just because a taxpayer is deemed to be materially participating for Section 469 or is deemed so by an overriding provision of 469, you can't assume the taxpayer is actively participating for Section 179 and vice versa. The obvious example here is let's take the purely passive investor with a working interest in oil and gas well. For Section 469 purposes, that person is basically not passive, is considered to basically have a non-passive activity. So therefore, it's not passive under 469. But since that person does nothing with regard to the oil and gas trade or business except send the check in, we're going to posit that as our working interest holder, that's all they're going to be doing in this case, that person would not be actively conducting a trade or business and could not take a 179 deduction by using that income and for the purposes of this. So there we have to use a smell test that's using the broad outlines given in the regulations. The next one to consider is Section 1362, which is if you have an S corporation that has accumulated earnings and profits, there's the excess passive income test and the fact that if we have excess passive income for 3 consecutive years, we lose our S election. The two tests are found in Section 1362 and Section 1375, and they basically have the same definition. For purposes of this test, basically passive investment income means gross receipts derived from royalties, rents, dividends, interest, annuities, sale or exchanges of stocks or securities. The interesting thing to note about that list is made up predominantly of items that are treated as portfolio income and specifically non-passive for purposes of Section 469 because they do not involve the conduct of a trade or business. So in this case, passive means items that are by definition, in many cases, non-passive under Section 469. And there are a couple of exceptions, so it's kind of interesting to get into that area. Now, the passive income rules for 469 are found in 469E1. Because of this differential, it's key that if you're looking at the issue of an S corporation that has to worry about the excess passive income rules, and it's an issue you always have to worry about if you have an S corporation that has elected S status after it was previously a C corp, and it suddenly sells off its assets and now it's skating by because the taxpayers, for whatever reason, don't want to liquidate the corporation or want to keep it around because, let's say, it has a highly appreciated piece of real estate that we're going to send out under a net lease, but if we push that out the door, we trigger the gain. If you have those situations, you need to worry about this or you could lose your S election in the short term. Let's take that case because a substantially appreciated piece of real estate is really the big issue that usually gets our problem here. The S Corporation was previously a C Corporation. It operated a business for years. Now we've got an offer to sell it. The buyer buys the business, doesn't want the real estate, or we don't want to give up the real estate, so we're not, you know, he's not offering enough, we're not going to sell it. We enter into, so we want to just lease that property to the new owner, hold on to the real estate. Now, if we liquidate the S Corporation, pass that real estate out, now we run into one of the gotchas about being a corporation and not being a partnership. In a partnership, we could push that out, no problem, and we wouldn't trigger the gain. The partners would take on the basis of their underlying interest in general in most cases. In an S corporation, that doesn't work because we would be forced under Section 311(b)(1) to recognize the gain anytime we distribute appreciated assets to a shareholder. And Section 311(b)(1) applies to all corporations regardless of whether they are C or S corporations. So since the owner doesn't really want to trigger that gain and pay tax for which he's not getting cash currently, the owner is going to say, well, I just want to keep operating as an S corp and we'll pass through the rents, and when I finally sell the building, then we'll liquidate the S corp. Well, that scenario runs afoul of the passive income rules. However, relief is granted in the regulations. You can do that under Regulation Section 1.1362-2C5IIB, always love references that long, where there's an exception for rents. And when it talks about rents derived in the active trade or business of renting property. Now, that may seem interesting to you, but remember, under 469, it was passive because we were told by definition, rental of real estate was going to be considered passive for purposes of 469. What we're going to do now is take a look at, now we're going to have the active conduct, which is similar to the term used in Section 179, of a trade or business of renting property. And it notes, rents do not arrive, do not involve, and basically rents does not include rents derived in the active conduct, active trade or business of renting property. Rents are derived from such an active business only if, based on all facts and circumstances, the corporation provides significant services or incurs substantial costs in rental business. Generally, significant services are not rendered and substantial costs are not incurred in connection with net leases. Whether significant services are performed or substantial costs are incurred in the rental business is determined based upon the facts and circumstances, including but not limited to the number of persons employed to provide the services and the types and amounts of services and of costs and expenses incurred, other than depreciation. You'll find there are a number of private letter rulings that have been issued on this point because this is crucial. In most cases, while it would be really bad to trigger the gain and pass it out today, it would be even worse to suddenly end up with a C corporation where suddenly we get stuck with a double tax now down the line because 3 years later we lose our S election and now we have this highly appreciated piece of real estate left in the corporation, no S election being valid any longer once we're examined and the IRS says, oh, you lost your S election years ago because you had more than 3 years of excess passive income. So we're going to assess you for the C taxes, and we're going to say, oh, by the way, and on the sale of the property here at the end, now you can pay both the C corporation tax plus the individual tax on the liquidation of the corporation. So that exception found is key in making it work. You should study the private letter rulings to see what has and hasn't counted. The taxpayer, also assuming a substantial sum is in question, may want to consider whether they want the safety valve of applying for a private letter ruling so they know for sure before the 3 years are up if they're going to lose their S status and therefore could decide if they want to liquidate now or if they want to change their structure or their leases in some form so that they can be considered to be actively involved in the conduct of the trade or business. But again, the issue here is not whether you meet the Section 469 test. This particular rental will almost certainly be a passive activity for Section 469, but that's not fatal under Section 1362's passive activity, passive rules. It doesn't mean that 1362 now has passive rental income for purposes of triggering the excess passive income tax. That's a separate rule. Finally, let's consider the self-employment tax issue, another area where tax practitioners tend to think, Section 469, I've got a passive investor, therefore it's a passive activity investor, he cannot be involved, he cannot have self-employment income, if only it were that simple. IRC Section 1402 tells us what self-employment income is. And right off in the beginning of Section 1402A, you're going to discover that for a partner, the general rule is all pass-through income that's related to a trade or business carried on by the partnership is self-employment income. That's important. The test is not whether the partner does anything. The partner can do nothing whatsoever with regard to this business. They can be totally a passive investor. They can be a passive investor that would not get Section 179. They can be a passive investor that's going to have this treated as passive income or loss under Section 469. Well, our concern is probably with passive income if we're going to talk about self-employment tax. But we'll continue. You could be passive for Section 469. Your 179 deduction could be disallowed. But you still could have trade or business income because the partnership is where we apply the test for conduct of a trade or business. That's important because if you take a look for, if you look a little bit further up in Section 1402A, you're going to find that if the individual carries on the is carrying on the business, the proprietorship, our test is whether the individual does anything. But once we're in a partnership, we don't worry about the individual taxpayer and what the individual taxpayer does at this point. We worry only about what the partnership does. There is, you know, for an individual, net earning basically requires carrying on the business, which is some sort of quasi-active relationship to a trade or business and something we regularly conduct. For the partnership, we're looking where the partnership carries on the business and it has an active conduct. Now, for an individual, while there's no direct link to Section 469, obviously some of the same factors will impact whether you're regularly carrying on a trade or business. That is, it's possible to but the cutoff point may be at a very different point. So it may be possible to be materially participating in activity Section 469 purposes, but not carrying on a trade or business for 1402 purposes. One example many practitioners may be aware of is the case of a person who receives fiduciary fees for handling the estate of one person. Let's say their mom dies. They have to handle the estate. They receive fees for settling the estate from the estate. Well, that normally, that's not subject to employment tax because they're in a trade or business of carrying on that activity, but that also doesn't mean it's passive activity income under Section 469. Because it does not create passive income there that can be all used to offset losses. That's a different concept. However, the view is very different if we look at a partner because 1402 applies the test at the partnership level. So whatever the partnership does, if it actively carries on the trade or business, let's say we have a partnership that provides fiduciary management services, and we have a partner who does nothing and sits off to the side, that person will still be deemed to be self-employed even though they did nothing. And that now we're going to have self-employment income because the self-employment income will pass from the partnership, presuming that individual doesn't meet an exception. Now, there's one important exception that may confuse practitioners because it's generally a case that automatically creates a statutory passive activity under Section 469H2, and that is if you are a limited partner and you hold a limited partnership interest. That is statutorily removed from self-employment income under Section 1402A13. The key factor, though, in both cases is the exclusion is statutory. Simply by definition, a limited partner obtains the classification of passive for the passive activity rule purposes and is not subject to self-employment tax in most cases. There is a limited exception for guaranteed payment we're not going to consider here. We're going to go on to this issue. But the partner is not, and this is important, not exempted simply due to the fact they are passive under 469. It is possible to be passive under 469 and have self-employment income under Section 1402. Don't believe it? Go to the 2000 tax court case of Norwood versus Commissioner TC Memo 2000-84. In that case, the tax court considered the case of an investor who was passive with regard to a partnership activity under 469. The court held that the petitioners argue that his interest in the partnership is passive, therefore any distribution from the partnership should not be subject to self-employment tax. The IRS contends the distribution is subject to SE tax regardless of whether the involvement is passive or active because he's basically a partner who's not a limited partner. The tax court agreed with the IRS. It's undisputed the interest in Gallant was a general partnership interest, with Gallant being the partnership in question. Accordingly, his distributive share of partnership's trade or business income is subject to the limitations, section 1402B, is subject to the tax on self-employment income. The petitioner spent a minimal amount of time engaged in the operation of Gallant is not relevant to this determination. Key importance, the fact the partner did virtually nothing or even did nothing is not relevant. His lack of participation or control over the operation does not turn his general partnership interest into a limited partnership interest. The court holds a limited partnership must be created in the form prescribed by state law. Therefore, there is no link between Section 469 and Section 1402 in the IRC, despite many practitioners acting as if the two are tied together. Now, these situations make clear why it's important to consult the actual text of the law than always shooting from the hip or trying to group together or make some sort of, quote, logical sense, unquote, of the rules involving disparate parts of the tax code and different issues that you're faced with. It's important to understand that all of these may conceptually turn around an idea of whether I'm involved enough in the business or my business is one where I'm doing enough or active enough. But they all turn on different rules, and those rules and their subtle differences can be extremely important to the outcome to your client. Unfortunately, Congress doesn't make things the same, and while we have the uniform definition of a child that we got in 2004, or somewhat uniform, we don't have the uniform definition of passive and active, and that's a key issue tax practitioners need to be aware of. Now, last week's podcast, I did a quick discussion of VISTA and related issues. I did want to point out, kind of funny today, I received in the mail from Tax Analyst, so I can give you one more program that's not compatible with VISTA. It turns out the Tax Analyst CD-based research products are also VISTA incompatible. So we have a number of nice, odd issues that create VISTA issues. If you are going to VISTA, as I said last week, it's probably a good idea to learn about how to install the virtual machine software on your machine so that you can run an XP machine for those programs that demand XP. I also found in another discussion group, the point was brought up that Lacerte, also like ProSystem FX, is incompatible with VISTA as of the moment. And that's not going to change in the near future, so I wouldn't necessarily run out and get a VISTA machine. Now, this has been the Tax Update for Saturday, February the 17th, 2007. As always, Tax Update is brought to you by Limeburg Information Services, located on the web at www.limeburgservices. Go ahead and visit the site, take a look at what's available, consider subscribing to their newsletters for updates on tax matters as they develop. Again, on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. This has been Tax Update.